This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chong and Ibrahim Sani this morning. 6 o'clock, Monday, the 15th of August. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Happy Monday to you guys.
Have no, a miserable weekend. Monday. Miserable.
How was your weekend, guys?
It was fantastic. My team won last night. Ibrahimovic, your namesake.
Oh, Wait a minute. So your team won and that made your whole weekend?
It didn't make it any worse.
Well, I spent the weekend with Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so I spent it reading the new Harry Potter book.
Was he a good conversationalist?
Not really. It was quite one-sided, I have to tell you.
Okay, so this is like a prequel or a sequel?
No, this is the new book that came out, The Cursed Child. It's not quite a book, and I found that quite disconcerting. It's like reading a script to a play.
Right.
And, you know, we're so used to reading like text, like normal text, right? So I had some trouble kind of reading a script because I was doing all the different voices in my head. You know when they go, Harry talks like this, then Ron talks like that. So that
this
was
is
a
how
fun
Melissa
weekend.
Idris spends a weekend.
Yeah, I know. A bit sad, isn't it?
Well, not really. It's quite intriguing how, you know, intelligent people.
The recesses of my mind. Yeah. Well, we've got lots of news and interviews coming your way between now and 10 o'clock. Today on The Breakfast Grill, Chong, you're going to be speaking to Mr. Sean Murphy, Global CEO of Procuri Group. They just listed in Singapore, didn't they?
That's right. So they're a data center for data centers. And basically, they're trying to upheave this industry because it's extremely fragmented. No one company has more than a 1% market share in any different sector. And basically, what data centers do is they alleviate all your network problems, all your IT problems, all the hardware, software, licensing issue. They take it all off your hands and they manage it for you on your behalf. But the problem is it's extremely fragmented and they're very localized.
Uh-huh.
So what he's trying to do is he's trying to do this whole global thing, and it goes much further beyond data centers in terms of managing, you know, hardware for established players, and it's all very complicated. And that was one of the questions I asked him about how do
investors want to invest in a company that they don't understand the business model of?
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
When you say it's fragmented, does it mean that there is even a need for them to consolidate these kind of businesses?
Yeah,
well, absolutely.
Because usually fragmented markets find a way to consolidate, right?
Yeah.
It's natural.
So it's quite interesting because You've got some of the biggest players in the market, some of the biggest Japanese conglomerates, and none of them have a big, huge stranglehold. And, you know, this whole industry is ripe for M&A, and I'm going to be asking him about that as well.
Fantastic. All right. Sean Murphy, Global CEO of Procuri, will be on the grill to discuss how the company plans to continue its growth post-listing, some of its prospects ahead. And after that, on current affairs, we're going to be looking at the maritime security of the Sulu Sulawesi Seas. Now, you know, we've all read the news reports of kidnappings, right, of the, remember the Indonesian sailors, also there was a recent case of the Malaysian sailors that were taken at that area. So enough is enough. Both governments of the Malaysian government and the Indonesian government have said, okay, we have to address some of these long-standing issues. It's been a hub for transnational organized crime for far too long, so we have to kind of address maritime security in this area. But the problem is, it's a tri-border area, so it also borders Philippines, and you can't do anything without the buy-in of the Filipino government. So how are we going to address this? Is cooperation between Malaysia and Indonesia enough to stem the security issues in that area? Let's find out more.
Yeah, the thing is, President Duterte doesn't have a rapport or doesn't have a history with dealing with foreign governments. And I think that was one of the core downside of his presidency. A lot of his political detractors argue that he's not good for presidency because of that, right? And I think this is a kind of opportunity for Philippines to come out and say, you know, we're actually quite okay in dealing with other countries, but they're not. You know, he's not actually reaching out for that. So President Jokowi and Prime Minister Najib Razak, they've been trying all their best in their own respective country press, trying to reach out to the Philippines. But to no avail, apparently Philippines just doesn't want to have a dialogue for now.
Yeah. Do you guys think about maritime security? I wonder whether it doesn't dominate the attention of people like us, or the media, essentially, as well, because it's hard to relate to. You know, you think of maritime security, you think only of This is only maritime authorities' problems, not really ours.
Yeah, exactly. If you're running, you know, trade links between nations and stuff, you know, your boats get hijacked, and that's not very.
Did you watch Captain Phillips?
I did, and it's quite. It was very scary.
That for me was a huge eye opener for the importance of maritime.
Yeah, because you got this huge vessel. It could be like X number of thousand meters long, and then you've got like five guys running it. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And your cargo is hugely valuable. You got a few billion bucks of stuff on it.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? Because. Before Duterte became president, he was the governor of this council, a province called Davao. And Davao is an extremely coastal link. They're very close to Sabah. He would know these kind of things personally. So it doesn't matter whether or not it resonates with the common folk. If he internalizes it and he wants to negotiate, he can. And just like Najib, just like President Jokowi, they were from coastal areas. Najib's from Pekan. What do you call this?
Is Pekan a coastal area?
Yeah, it is a coastal area. And President Jokowi is also from the coastal area of Jogja. So I guess, you don't need the common folk to be aware of this as long as the leaders internalize this. And for the longest of time, right, Indonesia and Malaysia has been talking about maritime security for aeons in the Selat Melaka security area, in the south of Singapore security area. But, so far they've only need to deal with both of themselves. They don't have to involve Philippines. But now when they have to involve Philippines and with
especially
a non-receptive...
with the Abu Sayyaf militants now involved,
Yeah,
right?
Because I've got the map in front of me, the Sulu Sea, then the Celebes Sea or the Sulawesi Sea. Mm-hmm. So it's north of the Sulawesi Islands. It's east of the Sabah, conurbation kind of thing. And it's just south of Davao, which is where Duterte is. And it's not a small body of water. Do you know what I mean? It's very deep as well, so...
And it also brings up the case of, the kidnappings and the ransom that's been asked, right? So no one acknowledges the ransom. And it's, in fact, it's an open secret that this is funding militant activities, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not as if you've got a Sabah and you have a, daiquiri by the sea and put your feet up and then there's a couple of guys
coming.
Well,
that's the idea. That's what Sabah tourism wants, But people are scared, right?
Exactly. Then people come in off to, a little sampan and off you go. You get whisked away and you might not come back with a head on. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a cheery thought on a Monday morning.
It is what it is, right? That's exactly why these two heads are coming together.
All right.
But they do have nice beaches, right?
They do. They've got lovely
they
beaches.
They do. They really need to address that. Okay, let's talk about the security issues in the Sulawesi Seas. That's on Current Affairs, 8:35 a.m. And every Monday, we have Pressing Matters. So today, I thought we'll do key highlights to the Postcode Journalism Campus 2016 that was in June. Now, I attended that event. It was essentially kind of a workshop for journalists talking about the state of Malaysian journalism. And this workshop was held, I think, about 12 weeks after the Malaysian Insider got shut down. And Jahaba Sadiq, the editor of Malaysian Insider, was one of the keynote speakers and also on a couple of panels that day. I found it very interesting because they had really top senior journalists. So Stephen Gunn from Malaysian Insider, Joan Lau from the Malay Mail Online, Masjaliza Hamza from the Centre of Independent Journalism. They were all on the panel talking about how they've seen Malaysian media progress. And it was really at a really interesting time because that was just when the Wall Street Journal had broken some of the major tipping points in the 1MDB story. The New York Times was really covering it from the real estate transaction perspective. And the question being asked by local media was, did we fail? Did we fail in our duties to report this case? And that was the topic of conversation there.
Yeah, I think the question is just moot now because obviously clearly we did fail. And we've had senior editors of the NSC very publicly tender their resignation saying that, it wasn't us who broke the stories, it was foreign media that broke the stories.
Ah, but you see, what I found interesting was the takeaway from that day was not so much that we failed in breaking those stories, we were ill-equipped to break it. So the debate and this discussion from that event
was prevented from breaking those stories. It prevented from writing those stories. And if you did write those stories, you will not have a job tomorrow morning. Do you know what I mean? So it's not as if we ask ourselves, where do we fail? It's how do we come out of this, this chasm?
But, these are online media editors talking. So slightly less restricted than I would say the print or broadcast media. They had a bit more flexibility to report both sides of the story. I found that conversation fascinating, and so I've put together a few excerpts from that day, just so that we too can listen to what they had to say.
It's worth noting that in the Press Freedom Index, Malaysia is ranked in the bottom 20th centile. We're ranked 81% in the form of 180 countries. Right now, we're at 146. You know, just to put in contrast, Finland, Norway, they're like number one and two. So we're so far behind in terms of the Press Freedom Index. I think that plays a lot in terms of, not just about breaking the story, because breaking is exclusive, right? It's about the debate, the analysis, the editorial, all that involves a lot of freedom. And I think, you know, you're right, even online, right, there's still restrictions imposed upon them, not as high as print, but at the same time, you know, we know the circumstances surrounding this industry.
It's very simple. You remove the government from shareholdings of media entities and you'll have a much freer press. And you remove a government from business and you'll have a much freer industry, because the Malaysian Insider, it basically went under because advertisers pulled out because they didn't want to have any association to do with TMI because of their political coverage. And they can do that because of the preponderance of business, of government in business. If we don't have government in business, like how Julian is a bug, that's a bugbear with Julian. And you have, you know, MNCs and private enterprises and a lot of private sector ownership of businesses in this country, then you don't have a problem with that.
We have to remember, though, it wasn't the government that shut down TMI. It was the owners who decided to shut down TMI.
But they shut it down because they couldn't meet costs, and they can't meet costs because advertisers don't want to put their money with them, and they don't want to put money with them because of the political coverage. It's very simple. Every single important, in fact, every single sector in this country is driven by a government entity. It's as simple as that. And anytime you've got dirty laundry with your media business, you just don't get the ad dollar, especially in an industry which is tightening, constricting every day.
There are news agencies like BBC who is still funded by the government.
In the UK, mate. They're funded by the TV licenses in the UK, which has got, 65 million people now. And they can afford to put one or two corals in, you know, Malaysia. And that's okay. They can meet costs that way, because it's funded by an economy which translates it 5.2 ringgit into one sterling, you know, pound sterling. So they can't make it.
Those are definitely some of the takeaways that I took from this event. And I'm going to be playing a recording from that event for you later today. It's a really interesting debate, and I would recommend you catch that or download the podcast if you can't catch it on radio. You can always go to our website, bfm.my, and look under Pressing Matters. Okay, couple minutes now to the quarter mark for 6 o'clock. Now let's take a look at some of the news that happened over the weekend. Do you realize it's actually 1 week to go for the Olympics?
1 week to go.
I've missed most of it.
Yeah, I know. I keep telling myself, don't miss this, make sure you catch that. But now a week has passed and we're just a week away till the end.
One thing I noticed was that the US celebrated their 1,000th gold medal. Not medal per se, but 1,000th gold medal.
Wow.
And the first gold medal they won was in 1896, when, I don't know, Malaysia was still the Straits Settlements, but you know, they won their 1,000th gold medal, and that's huge. We have yet to win our first.
Yeah, can we get that elusive gold? So far, Thailand, Vietnam, and Singapore have already clinched their gold medals.
Medal
prospects now hinge on badminton, cycling, and diving.
Yeah, you know, then I saw this schooling kid from Singapore. He's 21 years old, and he's in the pool with Michael Phelps. You know, that colossus of an Olympian. He's got 22 gold medals, and he beats Phelps over 100 meters in the butterfly. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you know that I had this conversation with a couple people over the weekend, and they were like, oh, but his mother's Malaysian, so we have some claim to him.
What? He chose Singapore, okay?
but the Malaysians who are in action today, Chong Wei, Azizul Hasni, as well as Mandalila, they are gold medal quality people. If you think about it, Azizul Hasni only lost because Sir Chris Hoy was just a millisecond, a microsecond ahead of him. That was how he lost in the Beijing Olympics and also in the 2012 Olympics in London. Chris Hoy is no longer in the circuit. Azizul Hasni can possibly win. Chong Wei has that ever colossal, you know, nemesis of Lin Dan that he has to face. But I'm pretty
lost
sure
to, lost the last two, you know, gold medal ties with him, right?
But the fact remains, you know, these three individuals, they've done, you know, great stuff. I have more than enough faith that they can bring back that gold.
Just on the subject of Malaysian parents and stuff, I mean, the international sporting arena is littered with Malaysian relations who have fled this country, gone abroad, lived overseas, and have now spawned these, you know, these Olympians.
And then we can say that, you know, his mother's second cousin was from Penang.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a million Malaysians living abroad. You've got to have some relation. I mean, look at Nick Kyrgios, right? This up-and-coming tennis player from Australia. His mum is Melayu, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Do you know what I mean? Right?
But there was some controversy with Mr. Nick Kyrgios,
right? Kyrgios is
a
bit of a loose cannon, some people, but...
Okay. 6:15 now. We'll be back with more in just a few minutes. Stay tuned to The Morning Run. BFM 89.9. Good morning. 6:21 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chuang and Ibrahim Sani. This Monday morning, the 15th of August. Now, imagine a world where you could live for a lot longer than you could right now. I mean, you could cheat death in a way by getting a new heart, a new liver, a new set of kidneys, whatever you need, whatever internal organs that have failed you, you could get all grown from your own body cells. Now, we are every day a step closer to achieving this, to science breaking the secrets of immortality, of slowing aging. Would you guys want to?
Definitely. That's why I signed up as an organ donor, because I want other people to sign up as organ donors as well. But in this article, I think what we're referring to is on the breakthrough in how science will actually help us age. This just reminds me of that story, The Island. Have you guys watched that?
Yeah, I've seen that. It's got a had a Marlon Brando in there, didn't it?
What? It did?
It did, yeah. He was the old guy. Yeah, he was the pudgy old guy.
Well, we're not too far away from that becoming reality rather than science fiction. But I guess it bodes the question, do you want to live longer?
That is the core question.
It's a much more complicated equation because even now to today, you know, simple injections and simple inoculations are not available to the majority of the global population. So what more these kinds of remedies? And you've got to ask yourself, medicine isn't as even as you would like because it's only available to those with means and with money to to spend on these on such things. So it's only the wealthy that get access to these things. And if you look at the global life expectancy charts, the most developed and the most wealthy nations have the longest life expectancies. At the top of the list are the Americas and the Canadas and the Frances of this world. And then you got to ask yourself, do you want to live that long? Because the other day I was in Bangsa at a mama, and I was sitting opposite this 90-year-old guy, very chatty 90-year-old guy. He used to work as
90 years
old, you know what I'm saying? he was a meter reader at Tanaga a million years ago. He retired at 55. That's like half a century ago.
Wow, so half his life he's not been working. Actually,
correct.
He spent more of his adult life not working than working.
Correct, and he was on a pension from Tanaga, which obviously, you know, derived defined benefits are not available anymore. And I said, so how's life? He goes, a bit sad, like, because all my friends are dead already.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Every 90 years old, how many of your friends are still around?
Yeah.
So you've got to be...
Mahdi's still around, yes.
Mahdi's still around, yeah.
But I see what you're trying to say here. In fact, if you think about it... there's this academic that comes on TED Talks every now and then. His name is Hans Rosling. He's a mathematician. At the same time, he's also a doctor. He likes to talk about the life expectancy, right? And he says that actually global averages have been improving irrespective of whether or not you're from Africa.
Correct.
Or you're from, I don't know, Germany, right? Global average used to be 38 when you are living in the 1950s.
38?
Yeah. 38, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And it became somewhere around 40. And then now it's about, you know, in 2010, global average is at 67 years old. So
I read in the US, life expectancy has gone up by 1 year in 1 year alone. Germany. So a year ago, it was like 78 for males. And then 1 year later, it went up to 79.
Yeah, so this is what Hans Rosling is arguing as well. The moment you reach a certain plateau, you will just have that marginal increase. So many of these countries are achieving that marginal increase, that 78 to 79 or 79 to 80. But other countries are making leaps and bounds, right? And you think about it, in Africa, with 67 last year, and now it's 68, 69. So we are all plateauing towards that, you know, 80, but everyone...
But still, that's still... I mean, the fact that it's increasing by every year, I think that's still... I guess you
it's
know,
significant.
Something significant.
And then you got to ask yourself, does the Earth have enough resources to support a swelling population? Birth rates are one thing, expectancies are another. And, you know, right now we've got something like 7.5-8 billion people, up from 1 billion
well,
200 years ago.
Population control is a very, very controversial topic.
Well, it is. Well, it is. You've got two means, natural and unnatural attrition, you know, things like wars and famines and things like that.
But I think the bigger concern that we should be talking about is also climate change, right? Can this planet address that 7 billion people
Absolutely.
Or 8 billion people?
Absolutely.
It's going to be 9 billion people very soon as well.
Well, okay, so the fact that science can do this now, or, you know, in our lifetimes, we might in fact see people living up to 100, over 100, and still be, you know, have a body that is
functioning
mm-hmm. and not in disrepair, so to speak. But, I mean, we're talking about all the negative things. Think of all the good things that can happen, right? People living longer. You could have, you know, grandparents, great-grandparents knowing their can see their 5 generations down the road.
Yeah, I mean, some of the best minds, some of the best thinkers, medical, you know, doctors, you know, extending their wisdom and their infinite knowledge and capabilities onto the rest of the world. I mean, the benefits will be immense. But then you got to ask yourself, who do you want to offer this olive branch of extended humanity to? Then you got to get the selection. You know what I mean? So you don't want
to... So it could come down to cost. You're saying who can afford
it? Well, yeah, cost is one thing, then criteria is another, because if you're not going to be a burden in society, why would you want to...
Oh my gosh!
But that's what it is, right? Then you got to ask yourself who deserves it and who doesn't. So that's a very complicated thing to ask.
But then again, you could, you know, you could eliminate certain diseases from society. You could eliminate, you know, cancer, for instance, by getting a new liver or new lungs, you know, because you could grow it out of your own cells.
Yeah, and then there's another complication, because you've got what is known as natural selection, you know, the whole Wallace Darwinism theory, right?
Absolutely.
How if you're the strongest and the fittest, more capable, then you survive. This thing upsets that whole equilibrium. And you know what happens? If you watch Terminator, you know that this whole cannot not be sustainable.
Okay, let's talk about the social aspect of this, because according to this article from The Economist, it says that this could also alter family life and our social fabric, because, you know, how many people who tie the knot in the 20s expect to be the same person 80 years later? So if you live to 100, what does that mean for monogamy, for family life, for the nucleus?
I think with all due respect to The Economist article, I think this this particular point that they're making, this particular argument, is more pertinent towards the Western society where everything is on an individual nature. I think with Asian as well as African family values, we live and we stay with our parents and our kids. It's really not common for one household to see 3 generations at least, you know, living harmoniously or disharmoniously.
I can't think of a worse hell than that. Living.
Yeah, but like, you know, but you see what I mean. Know, like we care for our elderly. Even if we don't stay with them, we care for our elderly in the same kind of social structure.
Yeah, look, and I come from a place like in Penang where, you know, the rich Chinese tycoons, they build these huge piles and they've got entire generations living them. I can't think of a worse hell than that. Do you know what I mean? Sorry.
And then they live longer, right? 80 years old.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
You know, this wing, that fella, that wing, this fella. Then, you know, you got like 75 people living in the same house. And it's living hell.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And they say, for those who believe in life after eternity, they say, you know, you can be in heaven or hell for eternity. Penangite can say, yeah, I'm doing it now.
Well, you know, it changes everything from family life to your work life. Because imagine, what do you mean retiring at 55, right? If you could live to 100, you'd need to retire when
you're
80.
Well, then the thing is, if you get old and you got no money, why would you want to live beyond what is naturally... Describe to you.
So this is the thing, right? So when we're talking about natural selection and all this, and Melissa, when you're talking about this extended life, you know, one of my best lecturers when I was in university, they're really old. They're like 60 plus, 70 plus. They've seen it all. They know it all.
Bought the t-shirt, got the video.
Professor Arif, he said, read the first line of the textbook, close it, because I'm going to teach you something else. That's the...
Fantastic.
You know, that's how life should be, right?
Okay, it's time for the first news bulletin of the day with Audrey Rush on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Janie's Got a Gun by Aerosmith there. I challenge anyone listening to that song not to do air guitar or air drums.
Funnily enough, I was outside doing that air guitar thing, actually.
Okay, I'm Melissa Idris with Ibrahim Sani and Kusu Chuang on The Morning Run with you, 6:40 right now. You know, sometimes we talk about all the bad news. You know, it's sometimes hard to get past all the bad news that flood our newspapers and the online websites. And it you know, diminishes our hope a little bit for the country. But since it's Monday morning, let's take a look at some of the good things that have happened in the past couple of years. There are some progressive policies that maybe we should give a little bit of airtime to, right?
Yes, we should. So this story was highlighted to me last night by a friend of mine, Irvina, and it's by chilisauce.my. And chili sauce is great, by the way, for some of the
humour. I love humor. Chili sauce.
And, yeah, yeah, social issues. Social issues, tambah pedas.
So, you know, they have these funny pictures, they have these funny taglines, and one of the stories that they carried this morning is on the five progressive things that Malaysia has undergone in the past 2 years. And the top one, right, the number one thing progressive Malaysia has ever done in the past 2 years actually happened about 1 week ago, when Uber and GrabCar might soon be legalized.
Oh, they've already been legalized. I think Cabinet has approved that already. But that's, I mean, it's good that that's happened. We were all cheering that case. I remember Chuang was, he had a little bit of a rain cloud on that, rained a bit on that parade, but that's okay.
Well, you know, it was actually a good thing because more revenue means better quality of life for all Malaysians, theoretically.
Mm. Well, we also saw, okay, so it was good news for us consumers. It was something that we've been talking about on BFM for quite a while now, championing the need for a level playing field, not just with Uber, but also for the taxi industry. However, there's been some backlash over the weekend. I think there was the Taxi Drivers Transformation Association. They've warned that taxi drivers are planning a 6-day protest for this if SPAD legalizes the services of Uber and Grab.
There is this pro-BN blogger on Facebook, and I keep on reading this guy's, or it could be lady, we don't know, it's a synonym, pseudonym, sorry. This person always takes the pro-gov stance. One thing that happened last night was that this person went on a rant against these taxi drivers. I would have assumed that he would have, you know, sided taxi drivers because of the many things that this person says. And he says that cabbies, if they are not, you know, progressive, then they will lose out.
Do you remember, Ibrahim, when we were talking about this story, I think it was on Thursday last week, we were talking about it and I was so excited about the prospect of SPAD and the Cabinet actually moving forward with this because they've been
you
talking
about it. You were positively gushing
on
the radio waves.
I was. And someone tweeted me and said, Melissa, I share your enthusiasm, but isn't it a tad bit sad that such progressive policies get you that excited? Things that should be, you know, normal in any other circumstances.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's true. But at the same time, progressive things do mean progressiveness, and I think we should celebrate it nonetheless.
Small victories, lah. Small victories.
Another small victory is on the Malaysian Film Festival. Apparently, it abolishes the language segregation. So this has, you know, gotten the government a little bit of backlash because those with a little bit of a nationalistic or pro-Bumiputra policy kind of guy, they would be against this. But at the
same
time,
this one also, I thought, was like good for us. Good for us. Somebody
no
came
more
in
segregation.
And said, okay, this was clearly a bad move. I wonder whether backlash actually creates some form of political will. You know, sometimes we wonder, like, what can we do? Things are so grim. There's nothing we can do to change things, right? But talking about it, but creating some kind of public backlash sometimes works.
It does. And, you know, the media have a huge part to play in this. And the more noise we make, you know, obviously the more ripples it creates. And I think that's a good thing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of some progressive changes in our law. Apparently, up to June this year, you couldn't sue your boss for sexual harassment. Now, apparently, people can sue their employers and employees for sexual harassment under the change of law. And I think,
I had no idea.
Yeah, I had no idea either. So this was very interesting. Apparently, a Tabung Haji employee, Asma Ahmad Noor, told she had a manager, and the manager, you know, tells her vulgar jokes. And, you know, so she wanted to sue her boss for sexual harassment. She couldn't do so. That was before. Now, people like that can actually take legal recourse. I thought something like this would have happened in Malaysia a long time ago, but apparently, you know, up until June this year, you couldn't.
Amazing. So this case made its way up to the federal court, which ultimately sided with Asma, ordered the manager to pay her 120,000 ringgit. Well, good for her for taking this case all the way up to the highest court of the country.
Absolutely. So this sets a very important precedent for all the aggrieved workers. And, you know, it can be sometimes two ways as well. So it's going to be very good for our case law.
So previously, before this landmark case, what people could do only was just complain to the employer. So if there was a case of sexual harassment within the office, all you could do is, you know, take it to HR and hope that the company will do something about it. But now, according to Women's Aid Organization, all the power is no longer in the hands of the employer.
Yeah. For large companies, you know, financial institutions, insurance companies and all that, they might have an instituted kind of way of dealing with this. Problem is, Malaysia, 60% of the economy is driven by SMEs. You know, I cannot imagine an SME department. They're already struggling to find business. Suddenly they have this sexual harassment desk at the HR department. I can't see that happening. So I think it's important for the government to step in.
This is very important. And I think you can't make too much of a facetious angle to this, because the aggrieved worker, it's actually quite a bit of a hell for the, the person.
Traumatic, isn't it? Okay, the other one is Paralympians now get the same reward as Olympians for winning medals. So in the past, Paralympics and Olympic athletes didn't get rewarded the same for winning medals. But since August 2013, things have changed. Khairi Jamaluddin, the youth and sports minister, have decided to give every athlete equal incentives.
Now, this is huge, because nowhere else in a progressive country does the Paralympians get lesser than the Olympians. And I think for the sports minister, youth and sports minister, Khairi Jamaluddin, to actually get this out there and done, I think that's a huge win for Malaysian athletes.
So over the weekend, I came across this news report about a disgruntled retired armed personnel. He lodged a police report. A former army personnel had lodged a police report over the decision to award lifelong pensions to our divers, Pandalela and Jun Hong. So they get, for winning the silver medal, they get a 3,000 ringgit lifelong pension. So he was very upset with that. He filed a police report. He said,
"No kidding.
What about the security force personnel who risk their lives to safeguard the nation? He thinks that far exceeds that of athletes who, I'm quoting him here, who only dived from a plank." So that's what he says.
He's got a point. He's got a point. And
really?
He's got a plank, He has a point, yes.
That too. And you know what? The thing is, it's a huge imbalance, right? Because sports people are sports people, and fantastic, and kudos to them.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who risk life and limb, you know, I have friends who are former army personnel, and I think they are forced into retirement at a certain age, and then they're told to make their own way in life at the very relatively early age of the late 30s, early 40s.
Right.
It's not easy, because all you know is the army. All you know is the military, and then you're foisted into the real world, and it's very tough.
To me, when I read this story, I thought that his anger was a little bit misdirected. When I read this story, I didn't think that my first thought was not that he was mad at Pandalela or Jun Hong.
It's the system.
It was, for me, I just read someone who fell between the cracks of the system. I felt like he was disgruntled because he felt his plight was not being...
Mm-hmm.
Well, have you seen,
paid attention true. To.
Well, have you seen Tom Cruise in Born on the 4th of July? You know, army vets who come back from war and whatever, and, you know, they could be, some of them could be crippled or you know, handicapped in one way or another. And then they don't have any support from society, and they're told to deal with all the stuff, with all the stuff going on. It's very hard. It's very hard.
So, you know, of course he's angry with the system because, you know, think about it. The alternative is what? We don't win medals or we don't reward our athletes for winning medals. I'm sure he doesn't want that as well, but, you know, a little bit more focus it's not the sport has to be given.
Yeah, I don't think he's mad at the divers themselves. Yeah, I think he's mad that the fact that, you know, army personnel, people who fought for this country, don't get the same recognition, the same kind of, we overlook the contribution that they give.
We've got the LTAT, right, which is the Armed Forces Fund. And actually, that fund has actually got a lot of money. Under that fold, there's Afin, there's Bastard, there's, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, good stuff in there. And the question is whether or not it trickles down to every retired army personnel.
Finally, the fifth progressive thing that was highlighted by Chilli Sauce is the Animal Welfare Act 2015. Finally, we can, you know, penalize people for animal cruelty, and at the same time, we can actually teach our human beings, Malaysians, to be just kind to each other and also other human
as
other
well animals. As animals.
Yeah, every time on social media, there will be, you know, every few months there'll be a post that goes viral about someone taking a photo which clearly shows animal cruelty, but they don't think it. They think, you know, let's take a selfie with this cat in a jar or like a dog that's been abused.
It's sick, I tell you. So, but now there's an act that means we can penalize these people and Malaysia.
Catch them on social media.
We're very progressive, actually.
Well, okay, so baby steps, right? So we want to create a better country, baby steps, and it's important to highlight whenever we make progress, not just taking steps backwards. Okay, 6:51 right now, we've got the news bulletin coming up at the top of the hour. But first, we've got the Rolling Stones with 19th Nervous Breakdown, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.